Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Court is here to hear oral argument in the matter of Elaine A. Brady, Relator versus the 14th Court of Appeals, Respondent. Court is allowed 20 minutes of oral argument by Relator, 20 minutes by Respondent, and 5 minutes of rebuttal by Relator. And we are ready to hear oral argument from Counsel for Relator.
May it please the court, my name is Glenn Dedell. I have the privilege of representing Relator Ms. Brady. Sharing time with me is Mr. Harold Hammett, who actually is here on behalf of a series of true parties in interest. The respective chairman of the State Executive Democratic Committee and the counties involved. And as the marshal has indicated, I'm happy to give him 5 minutes of my time. The court has received numerous papers from us on short order. I'll go basically to the heart of our points. The first point is that on the record that you have from the Court of Appeals engaged in extrinsic fact-finding due because of the fact that there was a dispute as to the number of registered voters contained in Ms. Brady's application and petitions. Our version of the fact is substantiated by my verified post-submission brief to the Court of Appeals is that the court asked for a stipulation. There was none. Basically following a long series of Texas precedent on that point, it's very clear that the Court of Appeals does not have jurisdiction to find facts where facts are in dispute.
Does the court engage in fact-finding if it takes the least restrictive number here and still finds more than the requisite number disqualified?
I think that it's a fair question, Judge, because the case law talks much in the same way as one deal in the trial court at post-summary judgment, in other words, that there was some evidence. It talks about opposing evidentiary contentions. I don't have a case that says that the court can essentially be Solomonic and split the baby and say, well, there's at least 27 that in Court of Appeals.
Let me say this.
Yeah.
You all do concede there are at least 27.
There's no question about that. In fact, Exhibit I to one of our supplemental submissions to the court, which I think you got today that was mailed Friday, lists the 27 that we concede were not registered voters.
And well, why is that a disputed fact if they take that number? Now, if they took 29 or 30, then it seems we'd have a different question.
The dispute goes simply to this, that before the court at the time it had to determine the number of registered voters was a contention by the relator Ms. Dunn that there were more unregistered voters, which would obviously have a, if there was finding more registered voters, would have a more significant impact from our perspective on the numbers. I mean, there's not a lot of law on the distinctions. That'll be for the court to split. It's admittedly a technical point. But I think that without a stipulation as to what the facts are, the court goes to extrinsic evidence and finds facts. And that this court's holding in Cobra Oil and Gas and Bingham versus Sutton, the Court of Appeals cannot engage in that kind of activity, even if it is on the technical side. The fact is they're looking at extrinsic evidence, which they're not supposed to do if it's disputed. Our second point
else could it be resolved?
The answer to that is basically what, where you have a dispute of that kind, the mandamus should be in the trial court. The Palermo case is actually on point in that regard. You had an election contest where there was a finding of fact, and that comes up. I mean, the trial court is obviously best suited to handle this in its ancillary division to resolve that point.
Can the qualifications of Ms. Brady still be determined by the trial court at this stage or not?
I think that under the trial court's jurisdictional grant of Section 24 of the Government Code, which flows basically now refers us to the Texas Constitution, to Article 5 of the Constitution. It can review by issue any writs as a matter of general jurisdiction. In fact, there are cases in which challenges are raised. At this point in time, the question is after after the dispute has been found and if the case is dismissed for want of jurisdiction, you go back to the technical provision of Section 141 that says you probably by the time it was done you couldn't have a challenge after the first day of absentee voter in person.
Why does that matter in this kind of race where there's each party has a primary but a candidate is uncontested? I would assume that has very real meaning where people are already voting in the primary.
Yeah. I think that the answer to, well, as a point on the equities in the issue, Ms. Brady is not opposed in the primary. Theoretically, as a matter of fact, I believe, as we suggested to the court, it would have expanded time to determine this issue because the real question is eligibility to sit in the general election. We know that you can't, at least our reading of the laws, you can't take her off the ballot, so I think following the principle that we're talking about, you probably could have a challenge at that point in time. The question is, would it come in time to decertify for the general election? It's a fair question. I think the point was, yes, there is an alternative form of remedy. The question is, was it best solved, assuming our position that there was a fact dispute, was it solvable by the Court of Appeals? And we say it's a jurisdictional matter. No. The second point goes to mistakes that we claim the Court of Appeals made in the actual calculation of the number of qualifying voters that Ms. Brady has by the methodology chosen by the Court of Appeals. You have received this morning three exhibits from us that set out each of the three names in question. Briefly, they are a voter named Jeffrey Lazar, who was challenged as not having a voter registration number. In fact, see from the form that he does, Ms. Dunn's brief that I received a little while ago indicates, well, there was a technical mistake. We really meant to say Sherman Lazar, which I find only a little ironic under the nature of the challenge that we've had to deal with. Because if the issue is good faith mistake should excuse Sherman, who has no registration number but was not challenged, to now raise a challenge to him, I'd say that we open the whole issue up as to those good faith mistakes that a voter might have made in one digit because she couldn't recall her voter registration number as she came out of the polls and signed an election petition. That, by the way, is basically the rationale that the Fifth Circuit used in the Pilcher case, Pilcher versus Raines, which we have raised this morning in our supplemental brief, raising the question of the constitutionality, which is the way the Court of Appeals applied the information requirement of the law in this case. Basically, if somebody is going to allow good faith correction, I think that the law would indicate that Ms. Brady should have that benefit. But the fact is, they challenged Jeffrey Lazar, not Sherman, and Jeffrey, in fact, qualified. Second voter we deal with Crystal Dennis, who was listed as being registered, not having a number. She had a number and she was registered.
What's the exhibit on that?
It is...
I'll find it, never mind.
You have it? Yeah. Let me see if I went in my own order. Lazar is Exhibit B, and what we've done for the court is basically used Ms. Dunn's own exhibit and taken the signature block out that shows in the case of Mr. Lazar, Jeffrey Lazar, the one that was challenged, that he had a number. The law is also fairly clear that the challenge is discretionary. I'd say that if the question is if Sherman was really intended, I'd say at the time this was presented to the Court of Appeals, that claim was waived because it was not asserted. I mean, it says Jeffrey, we're assuming it's Jeffrey. The last issue, which, and by the way, I believe my brother, Mr. McKinney, will concede in his brief that Crystal Dennis is a registered voter, and that he will also concede that the Court of Appeals miscalculated the number of voters who did not have cities and zip codes, who were otherwise registered voters. If you use their list and you subtract the number who were previously disqualified as unregistered voters, you come up with 6 instead of 7, which is what the Court of Appeals came up with, 7. That's actually the first exhibit. Exhibit A has that, and we've crossed out the ones previously disqualified, and simple arithmetic will show that it comes to 6. And the corresponding the numbers of the disqualified ones are from the superimposed corner. If we assume, for argument only, that the Court of Appeals followed the correct form of analysis, which we dispute, by their own calculations, they should have given us 250 instead of 247, which would keep Ms. Brady on the ballot with sufficient signatories. That's fairly straightforward. But moving, that's clear. Moving to the issue that I think gets to be the principal issue in this case is really, how is this information subdivision of section 141.063 being applied? And it's in looking at that we came to the position of asserting here that as the Court of Appeals applied the subdivision to the information requirement, they did so unconstitutionally, because there was no purpose served by asserting those requirements to disqualify voters, because there was no claim of fraud, harm, or hindrance. And it's important in this regard to look back to the Constitution, the Texas Constitution, Article 6, Section 4, which is the enabling provision that creates the right for the legislature to create rules concerning elections. And it says that the legislature shall enact laws to prevent fraud on the ballot. And there has been no claim of fraud on the ballot here. What we have is, as I said, in the Court of Appeals, and for which I was somewhat chastised, a very hyper-technical challenge to disqualify voters by making informational hurdles that will effectively prevent these voters from having the candidates that they want to have on the ballot on the ballot. The Fifth Circuit has said, in Filcher versus Rain, that is unconstitutional. The issue there, interestingly enough, was the requirement of putting a voter registration number on a minority party election petition. The difference, of course, is we're talking about a minority party there as opposed to an individual candidate. But in each instance, they share a common nexus, because the courts have found, especially the Supreme Court in Anderson versus Celebrezzi, and in the earlier case, which is Bullock versus Carter, in which the Texas election code was found unconstitutional for a fee by the Supreme Court, the rule has been that when you do anything to affect candidacy, you have an effect on voters. You have restricted their First and 14th Amendment rights to express political speech. The courts have taken two ways around that. They've either gone First and 14th Amendment analysis or equal protection analysis, turning on fundamental rights. We think that what the Court of Appeals did here was, without any justification on the ground provided by the Constitution that created the statute, that is fraud, there is none. In fact, they were able to distinguish the voters' registration number so specifically that they could criticize them in their petition for writ of mandamus, saying, well, she missed here, this is the right number, this is the wrong number. Okay, no fraud. The proposal that we put in our supplemental brief,
there are signatures that ought not to be on that.
There are signatures of unregistered voters, that's correct, Judge.
Why isn't that fraud?
Because there is no showing that it was a deliberate attempt to mislead anyone. What happened in the process of getting signatures, I don't know if members of the court have done this personally themselves, but you go out, and in the instance, let's say you go to a polling place, and you have the best place to find registered voters is people who've just voted, which is in fact what Ms. Brady did here for most of these signatures. The assumption is that if the state let them vote, they're registered voters. Well, in fact, a number of the signatures we have here are people who didn't have voter registration certificates. I think that the literature...
The problem is not on the part of your client.
Well, it's not fraud. If it's a mistake, that's what the challenge is meant to cure. Mistake is different from fraud. And, I mean, there's been no claim of fraud on the part of my client. What I think that the problem with this statute is it's not unconstitutional on its face. The question is how it's applied. It's our proposal that the logical way to interpret the statute is to essentially treat it as creating a rebuttable presumption that there is invalidity in the signature that can be rebutted by the candidate by showing a valid registration certificate.
Counsel, very quickly, could you go down the numbers with me? We start with 302.
Yes, Judge.
Unregistered voters, 27.
That's right.
Okay, now, how many do you show have, according to your numbers, the wrong registration numbers?
The court found 15. I believe that because we find in the list used by the true party in interest that Ms. Dennis was a correct number and Mr. Lazar was a correct number, that would mean a 13. So I have not done that calculation. I mean, that would be the logical way to get the two out of that pile.
How many were rejected because of no city and no zip code?
The court rejected 7, though, using the schedule and the numbers from the disqualified voters comes to 6. It should have been 6, and the true party in interest concedes that.
Are you conceding the failure of a zip code is a defect under this statute?
I guess what I'm saying is that failure to include a zip code is not being in compliance with the information requirement, because though it says address in the statute, in fact, if you go back to the section 1.0, the definitions, residence is defined as city and zip. So, I mean, on its face, 141.0632 doesn't say zip code, but the courts have held zip code to be a requirement. I mean, we would say that it procedurally, a full address would even include the state of Texas, which is held not to be a defect in address, though I suffer with that one because it's hard to mail something in the mail without sending it to a state to leave.
I am interrupting Judge Cook's question, and I apologize.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Judge. But if you have a city in a state, the zip code can be discovered by judicial notice, can it not?
That's
there
true.
There's a zip code directory.
There's a zip code directory. If you have the registration certificate, you have all that information.
I'll go back. I'm just curious about that.
We show no city and no zip code 7. You claim it's 6. I don't see the case cited, but it's listed under 141063. It says signatures which accompany prospective candidates' application to be on the general election ballot and which gave street addresses, PO boxes, or rural route numbers but did not designate the city or town were valid. I don't see that case cited.
I don't know if
that's the case of Hoot versus Brewer.
Hoot is cited in our material.
Okay.
I mean, we've cited Hoot. Basically, you will find, if you include the Shipley case that was decided last Friday in the first court, with the copy of which I've submitted to the court in my motion to file supplemental pleas, I mean, you have courts doing different things. You have courts that say no zip code is a defect. You have courts that say improper name is a defect. You have a court that says improper name is not a defect. Basically, the question is, what is it that the statute was intended to cure, and the question
that's to verify.
That's right. And what my position is that is a procedural issue that should be, in order to not suffer the constitutional infirmities that the Fifth Circuit found in our election code in Pilcher versus Rain, should be interpreted procedurally, which is raise a challenge and have a response with a copy of the certified registration certificate, which resolves the information issue one way or the other. That's the logical way to do it. If you don't do that, you're going to have a tree with literally scads of cases that carve out different common law distinctions, which is what you have now. The opinion of the 14th court...
Would the chairman of the party commit error in not accepting a petition that had these kind of defects? If we go to a substantial compliance rule, where does the discretion lie? With the chairman of the party, or does it lie with each court still, and we say, yes, that's an error, but it's not enough?
Under our proposal on how the statute would be construed, the chairman would accept those signatures. That he or she felt, in their opinion, constitute compliance with the law, which is in fact what the chairman did here, as he indicated in his affidavit. The question is the challenge then, challenging under Gray versus Vance in the case to talk about the purpose of this thing being to verify is, it's at the discretion of the challenging candidate. It's not mandatory. The candidate can determine that these names are okay. I mean, it's up to the challenging candidate that says, I don't have enough information to raise it. What I'm saying is that we seem to have gone off into a hypertextual zone that could be solved simply by saying, well, if the question is information, which is what people say it is, then create a system, a simple system, which says, I challenge there isn't enough information, rebuttable presumption, invalid. You, party chairman, you voter, you candidate, come up and show me copy of your certified registration certificate, which contains all the information you would need. Actually, the Fifth Circuit said you don't need all that information to find out what you need to know. The Fifth Circuit's discussion was address can be found in several ways, which is true.
I have one question. Counsel, it seems that the simple method is set out in section 141.064. It says the person circulating a petition must, before the petition is filed, verify each sign as registration status and ascertain that each registration number entered on the petition is correct. That's a very simple method of verification.
The answer is, Judge, I can't dispute that what is in black and white in the statute book has a clear presentation. But as the Fifth Circuit has pointed out in Pilcher, and I think what the operant reality is, it's especially for non-incumbent candidates who are struggling to get these names together, that it poses a burden to go back and individually verify each number. That often the affidavit says verify registration status, which I read as saying if the affiant believes, if I say to the voter, are you a registered voter as they come out of the precinct house having voted, I'm going to consider that I have verified registration status, especially if I'm short on time and short on names. I might not have the time to run to get names and go down to the county courthouse and check on the registration. I mean, it can be done. It has been done. Judge Pressler pointed out to us that he personally verified 1,000 signatures.
The burden that we're talking about here is not verifying 1,000 signatures, but only 250.
That's true.
Which could be done in a matter of less than 2 hours.
No.
I would dispute that, Judge.
I got a random microfiche machine to go off the record again. Put in those little cards. It took me about 3 days.
The question is not can it be done. The question is what is sufficient. It's not what she didn't do. It's what she did do. Does she have enough registered voters? Because the system works on registered voters. They're the ones who have the right under the Constitution, federal and state, to put a person on the ballot. And she had more than 250. That's, I hope, not in dispute anymore. The question is, with that, then, you know, did she give them enough to verify? And the answer to that, I think, is yes. We now have, unfortunately, the whole thing.
You're into our time.
I apologize. Let me give the floor to my colleague, if I would. I'm sorry, Judge.
Is there more time? Does the court have any objection to allowing 5 minutes for the party? So we will allow an extra 10 minutes to respond. Is that agreeable?
Yes.
All right, you may have 5 minutes and you'll have enough.
Thank you, Judge.
For an additional 10 minutes, I guess we went five over there.
Hey, please
the court. Mr. Hammond, continue arguments for the position. Hey, please the court. Harold Hammond from Fort Worth, representing Bob Slagle, chairman of the State Democratic Executive Committee. In the brief time that I have, may I just mention to you the problems that we have under court, the recent court decisions in administering what used to be called an ironclad mandatory duty on candidates as opposed to just merely language saying it's directive as to voters. And in line with what the Chief Justice mentioned, we felt that in this situation we had to exercise discretion to permit Mrs. Brady's name on the ballot because of this. We have a case that says if the city is not on the petition, that's okay, even though the election code specifically requires the city to be there. There was another case, and we cited these in our supplemental brief, that says if the state is not included, well, that's okay. That's not mandatory. There was another one that said, it's Leal versus Mather, where the year was omitted, even though that's supposed to be in it according to the, quote, mandatory language of the election code. So here we have three instances here where three holes have been poked in the dike, and I interpreted that in advising Chairman Slagle and our primary director. It looks to me like the courts are indicating to us that no longer is the law what it may have been some years ago, that every petition or every application must be 100% letter perfect without exception.
This court has not written a petition case recently.
No.
Realizing that we would hope these things would be applied evenly across the board, what would the party like to see in petitions? Would you like to see this kind of discretion, substantial compliance? And if so, how much would the party like to have there? Or would you like to see a letter, the statute enforced to the letter, so that everybody would know?
Your Honor, for our clerical duties, in administering primaries, the party machinery does that. You know, clerically, it would be a lot easier on us if we just said, absolutely no exceptions, state, city, anywhere, make it absolutely perfect. Anything that a computer can't find is perfect, well, it's no good, we can't accept it. But that's just half of the, or part of the duties of a political party. It's also to field candidates. I would feel and would hope that the court would consider saying that in line with what is implicit in some of the Court of Appeals cases, that the election administrators must use the discretion. I would suggest that a test be, as has been referred to just briefly before, whether it's an abuse of discretion in accepting a petition or an application that's less than 100% perfect. As I read the cases, what came to me from in advising Chairman Slagle to go ahead and accept this, that an application does not have to be 100% perfect.
Do you think there might be a band in there where the party chairman could accept or reject, and the court should uphold that decision?
Unless it's
on an identical petition.
If
the identical petition was submitted with identical defects to the other party, and one party accepted and the other rejected, the court should respect both of those decisions. It's saying a matter like this, which is obviously very close.
Yeah, this is close, Your Honor. I admit that, and readily concede that, as far as even the type of discretion that I would think that all election officials ought to have, state and county level, this one is just barely within the permissible boundaries of tolerable sloppiness. But it if the test is that if the documentation does have and does contain enough of the basic information to have a rational, common sense relationship to the purpose it serves, and there's no dishonesty or fraud, harm or hindrance, then the election official, within his or her discretion, should be authorized to accept the petition.
I like your quote, tolerable sloppings, okay, but the term that we often hear is, in other words, is it de minimis? And how would you say that? Here we're talking about three, would you say 1%, 2%, 3%? In other words, does tolerable sloppings, would that include a 3% error factor?
It would depend on what you apply it to. For example, you could have 250 signatures with no city. Some might view that, several percentages because it's repeated so often, yet in one case it's held that's not needed. I don't know. I can't really quantify it in that respect.
Right. It's hard for us to write tolerable sloppiness as the guideline.
I was not suggesting that as the guideline, Your Honor. I was saying that with, under the guideline that I mentioned just now, that if there's enough basic information on the document to ascertain the essential information that has a rational relationship to the purpose to be served by the petitioner of the application, and there's no dishonesty or fraud, harm, or hindrance, then that's sufficient. It's in conclusion similar to what the Houston 14th Court of Appeals said in upholding a petition that omitted the year. That's okay. So otherwise, it would be to close our eyes to reality. And if that court did not do it, and we would respectfully request the court to adopt
it. If substantial compliance is the test, how can we issue a writ of mandamus which applies to ministerial duty?
Well, that's what we raised in our brief in the Court of Appeals, that there's no language specifically in the election code that says unless a petition or an application is 100% letter perfect without any error at all, the party chairman shall reject it. There's nothing in there like that, and we had suggested that, and then it was not persuasive to the Court of Appeals that what they're trying to mandamus us for the way we exercise discretion. Forgive me, Your Honor.
No, I didn't want to. Do you think then that this may be the kind of issue that can only go to a trial court?
In this particular fact situation, yes, I do.
Well, but on end, Judge Pierce makes a good point. If if we're going to allow some leeway in the law, as the Court of Appeals has, then at some point we cross the line where it becomes where our own mandamus law will not allow corruption.
I think you have that in any instance, and I don't know that in every, but in several instances, where it's a matter of ruling on discretion. There will be some things that will be so absolutely serious that...
Mean what? Where it's a matter of discretion that would justify a mandamus. Mean what?
Well, if it's beyond the scope of the traditional boundaries of abuse of discretion, the courts have held whether it's an injunction or in other matters, what I was referring to, Justice Spears, where you say this goes so far that it's an abuse of discretion.
If there weren't 250 names of any sort here, it seems to me it would be clearly mandamus.
Sure.
If there were 249.
Yeah. Right. In other words, if they came in with instances where there were just printed names, for example, that only, and in a moment of whatever moment, well, we accepted such a petition. I think that one is clearly beyond the pale as being obviously an abuse of discretion. Otherwise, we're getting back to the extent that we ever were there, to the notion that if we're going to require absolute perfection, then there really would be all kinds of cases that would have to be overruled from the courts of appeals. And it's harder for us administratively, but in view of the letter and spirit of law, the intention of what the legislature had in mind in making these requirements, to suddenly require perfection when it's a just result that the Code Construction Act suggests that this could be interpreted, I think would be going too far to require the type of perfection that the Court of Appeals
should. Are you using perfection interchangeably with compliance?
I apologize, Esther, I didn't hear.
Are you using perfection interchangeably with compliance?
Yes, in that extent.
Any other questions?
Just one. We have a late filed exhibit from the county clerk of Harris County that informs us in this exhibit that the ballots by mail have been mailed and some have been returned. Ms. Brady's name on these ballots?
Yes, she is. And in that respect, if the court were to hold Mrs. Brady ineligible, we would urge that the same remedy be applied as was done last week, where her name must still stay on the ballot.
Would that allow the party to substitute someone else in?
In my opinion, it would. Yes, Your Honor. Thank the court for its courtesy. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. We will allow 30 minutes then for the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. McKinney and Mr. Weber will present argument for respondent. Mr. McKinney.
If you may please the court, my name is Troy McKinney, and I, along with Joe Reynolds, represent Justice Dunn in this action. We were later below, and we're the real party in interest here. I think several things need pointing out initially. First, there was no fact issue in the Court of Appeals. Relator's contention in that regard, in his brief in this court, is just simply flawed. As the Court of Appeals wrote in its opinion, it asked Relator, Brady, in the court below, if it had any evidence whatsoever to contest the numbers used in the opinion. And at oral arguments, Brady answered, "No, I don't." It served as the basis for the statement in the Court of Appeals' opinion that Brady did not contest the numbers used in the opinion. Now, if Brady desired to contest the numbers that were recited during oral arguments and that the court asked about, Brady had a week after the time of arguments before the opinion came out with which to do it. Brady filed a supplemental brief but didn't raise that as an issue. It seems wrong to me that a party should be able to not make an argument in the Court of Appeals on a mandamus action and then come to this court and make the argument that was not made below. If it would have been a basis below, it should have been raised in the Court of Appeals so the Court of Appeals could have addressed it. It wasn't, and it shouldn't form a basis for this court to vacate the Court of Appeals' writ. With respect to the numbers count.
Before we get to the numbers count, putting that on the margin for the moment, I think the Court of Appeals has authority to remove a candidate from the ballot?
I do.
Within 60 days from the election, 62 days?
I do, and I'll explain why. Oh. I understand what this court wrote in the Sears opinion and relied on section 172.058A as a basis for not ordering the removal of the name of the candidate from the ballot. There is an important distinction between that case and this case. Sears dealt with the eligibility, the constitutional eligibility in that case. Eligibility and compliance with the application requirements of the statute are two entirely different things. Section 172.058A in the second line, first sentence, says that 172.058A says that in situations where a candidate has filed an application in compliance with the requirements of the election code and then is later declared ineligible, his name will not be removed from the ballot. There was no question in the Sears case that Judge McCorkle had filed an application that complied with the statutory requirements. 172.058 was fully applicable. The issue there was eligibility, and this court held that it was constitutionally ineligible. The decision in Sears was correct, but for the same reasons it was correct, it doesn't apply here. Because of the exception written into the statute, the issue here is not eligibility. Nobody questions that Elaine Brady is constitutionally eligible to hold the office. That's not the issue. The issue is the compliance with the statutory requirements for the application.
Hasn't the voting already started, apparently?
The voting has not started. Some ballots have been mailed out, and the statute itself provides the operative deadline. The deadline is not when absentee ballots are mailed out or when they may be received. The deadline for bringing the action is under, I don't recall the section, is the day on which absentee balloting by personal appearance begins. Legislature clearly has the right to set the deadline for bringing an action to challenge it, and they chose the operative deadline as the day before absentee balloting by personal appearance began.
But that tomorrow. Day is tomorrow?
That day is tomorrow.
So we would be, if we followed the original Court of Appeals opinion, as you've urged, we would be disrupting the balloting in Harris County and 13 other counties?
No, not necessarily. In 1988, a writ was granted for Judge Cohen a few days before the balloting began. And as I recall, and I don't think there's any official record of this, what the party did was send out an instruction with the ballots along with a black magic marker and say, cross it off.
Counselor, is the date of absentee voting in person, is that the 21st or 20th?
The 21st is the day that absentee balloting in person begins, and the day before is what the statute sets for.
It has to be done by midnight today or midnight tomorrow?
Midnight tomorrow. Midnight tomorrow. I'm sure we all worked to midnight last night, too. The section that sets that deadline is important for another reason, because that's the section that sets forth language that says you can challenge an application for compliance with form, content, and procedure up until that time. So if you read that section in 141, I believe it's 064, in harmony with 172.058, they mesh together very nicely. One applies to an application and compliance therewith. One applies to either constitutional or statutory eligibility. They're two different items.
Are they? Are these cases that put some slack in the play? Well, are we too on that subject?
Well, I'm not convinced, you know, that one is of the both of them is not. You know, 250 signatures are required for in order for a person to be eligible on the ballot, is it not?
So eligibility is defined by the election code in section 141.001. There's a specific list of things that are set out that makes a candidate eligible for to run for the office. Once those things are complied with, eligibility is a term of art under the election code and in the Constitution. Has a specific definition, a specific meaning, which is used throughout the election code. Application and the compliance with the application requirements is also used consistently throughout the election code to mean the same thing throughout. And if you attribute the same meaning to the application process and eligibility throughout, the two can be read in harmony without any conflict at all.
Counsel, how do you read it in harmony, the statutory scheme? In a lot of counties, all you got to do is pay a filing fee. You don't have to have it. Here, the legislature has provided, as I understand it, you can either file with a certain number of signatures and no filing fee, or you can pay a filing fee and have a lesser number
Correct.
Of signatures. How is that uniform?
Between the large counties and the small counties?
Right.
It's uniform on the basis of the number of people who want to get on the ballot. The Supreme Court of the United States has recognized many times that the state has an interest, and a significant interest, in limiting an unlimited ballot size. And the likelihood of that occurring is historically much greater in the larger counties, and thus it serves as a rational basis, and indeed furthers the state's interest in limiting a huge ballot.
What's the number of... Is it the number of courts in a county or the number of residents in a population?
Number of residents is what the statute sets forth. I believe it's 850,000.
800. So only those counties where there's 850,000 or more people does this apply to.
Correct.
Would you think it would make just as much sense if they put some kind of a requirement in there depending on how many courts are on the ballot?
I think perhaps it very well could.
If we went to a less than a countywide system, it might very well solve that problem for us rather than having this horrendous number of courts on the ballot.
It very well could, because the quantity of people that you would be drawing from four places on the ballot would be much smaller. And if that's the justification for allowing slightly more restrictive procedures to get on the ballot, then the smaller populace within a single-member district would cure that problem, the same way that in the smaller counties they did not face the problems of large ballots, like the large counties oftentimes do.
Now, my question, I think we're to, do you think that these Court of Appeals cases, the ones that indicate there's some play in the joints, are just wrong and should be rejected by this court, or that we should recognize those, but even recognizing those, this situation goes too far?
I believe the cases you're talking about are Leal, Bacon, and Cohen. I think those cases are correct. And those cases do not implicate a strict compliance versus substantial compliance. And let me tell you why. In those cases, the issue was, could you tell from the information that was on the face of the petition what the excluded information was, what the missing information was? That was, in my opinion, the operative, and I represented both Bacon and Cohen in those. That was, in my opinion, the operative issue there. Was could you infer the missing information from other information present on the ballot, or present on the petition? And the courts both held that you could, as well as some other cases out of the First Court of Appeals, and thus held that there was no defect. With respect to the word Texas, the courts held that from the presence of the city, a zip code, the fact that there was a Texas voter registration number on there, you could infer the fact that the person lived in Texas, and thus it was sufficient.
Why can't you always find the zip code if you know the address?
If you have the correct address and city, you may be able to. And I think that's one of the problems here is, even if you compare, there were 21 additional persons that Carl Smith refused to certify as registered that Brady brought forward certificates of registration for, claiming they were registered. If you compare the addresses on those certificates of registration with the addresses on the petitions, you'll find that 16 of the 21 have different addresses. So the question then becomes, which is the correct address? And that goes back to the beginning premise that if you have the proper information on there to begin with, you never have to reach that inquiry. If it's correct in the first place.
How do you distinguish the Hoot case where it says where they did not put the city or town, but they were still held valid?
In Hoot, the court was dealing with the construction of the statute applicable to an independent candidate. At the time Hoot was decided, I believe it was Article 13.08D, required only a residence address, and the code did not define residence address. In the context of the Hoot opinion, the court recognized that there, at the time, was a similar provision, 13.50, applicable to general candidates that did define residence address. In the context of the opinion, I believe it was Justice Duggan writing it, said that if we were discussing the defined residence address and not the general one that doesn't have a definition, this would be defective. Relied on an attorney general opinion, DAD 42, that made the same comment. It said because residence address is not defined in the statute that we're dealing with in this case, we don't have a question of determining whether or not the information on the petition applies to the statute. But if it did, then it would present a different issue and the information would have to be there. The issue in that case was diametrically opposed to what's here because in this case, residence address is defined by the statute. I think perhaps the addition of the definition in 1.0517 may have been a legislative response to Hoot versus Brewer, making it clear and eliminating the inconsistency between independent candidates and general party candidates, providing the definition for a residence address. In Hoot versus Brewer, the court cites another case and discusses a case called Shields versus Upham. In that case, been relied on by many courts of appeals. Although the general goal of the election code requirements is to allow verification, that's not the litmus test. The test is, as set forth by the statute, says to be valid, a signature must contain A, B, C, and D. And in order to be valid, it must comply with the statutory requirements, despite the fact that the ultimate goal of the statute is verification. In that same context, I would suggest to the court that the errors in this case demonstrate very clearly that the type of information missing off these signatures is the type of information that prevents easy verification. Let's take the unregistered voters, for example. Initially, Ms. Dunn and some of her assistants went through the registration records and came up with the 58 number. They submitted it to Carl Smith and he verified it. Not once, but twice. On two different affidavits, each of the 58 people was verified as being unregistered. After those three steps had been gone through, Brady went back to Carl Smith and said, go back and recheck these. Do it a little closer. Maybe even compare some other information and go look somewhere else and determine something else. And Carl Smith came back with another affidavit saying, well, 10 of these really are. So after that fourth try, Brady's people went back a fifth time and decided to try and get a little bit closer. And they went and got 21 voter registration certificates that Carl Smith didn't think were sufficient enough to certify as registered, but that they submitted as evidence that these people were in fact registered. And of those 21, five are entirely different names. Maybe a first name similarity, but there's a difference in the name in those five. 16 of them have different addresses. Many of them have variations in the signatures that are plainly obvious. And the bottom line to all this is, if the proper information was contained on the petition in the first place, we wouldn't have these problems. If the person that swears to the affidavit at the bottom, like the statute requires, does what he swears to, and does verify the correctness of the information on the petition, verify its completeness that he has sworn to in the affidavit, then we don't have these problems. But the fact that this information is missing is exactly what has made verification difficult in this case. Not easy. The fact that we've put in literally hundreds of hours trying to verify all this doesn't mean that we've been ultimately successful. And I think that's best evidenced by some of the differences in numbers that are still cropping up today. The fact that the lack of this information does in fact make it extremely difficult to verify.
Well, what rule is it you're asking us to adopt?
I'm asking you to adopt a strict compliance rule, a rule that says the statute says X, it's unambiguous on its face, the legislature used the words must and shall, It meant what it said.
I thought you just stated that the two court of appeals cases that you were the counsel of were correctly decided, and they didn't use that tense.
I believe the result was correct, because you could infer the information from the face of the petition.
Well, it seems like you're saying two different things.
I argued in that case, and from a strictly technical standpoint, the word Texas should have been on there. The statute says Texas will be there, in plain and clear terms. That doesn't mean that I think the result they reached is ultimately wrong, because Texas is there. It's just not written as TX. It's written as the state that goes with the city of Houston, or the state that goes with the zip code, or the state that goes with the Texas voter's registration number, even though it is not written as TX. And alternatively, I would freely make the same argument I made in the Court of Appeals 2 years ago, that Texas is required. I think there's some good evidence of that. The Secretary of State this year, even though it wasn't on there in 1988, has added Texas, pre-printed it on all the forms. So to the extent that his interpretation of the election laws has any influence, his addition of it may in fact overrule Bacon and Cohen, or at least question the validity of them. The constitutionality issue is one that really isn't ripe for review for a couple of reasons. First, it wasn't raised in the court below. It wasn't addressed.
This is an original proceeding, though.
It is an original proceeding, but it's challenging the result the Court of Appeals below reached. And it seems to me that if somebody was a party to the proceeding below and was able to litigate whatever issues they wanted and chose not to do so, that they shouldn't be allowed to come to this court and raise issues that they could have raised below. Well, let's take it to its extreme. Let's assume that they decided to do absolutely nothing in the court below. Nothing at all. Didn't file a response, didn't do anything. The Court of Appeals issued the writ, and then afterwards, they come to this court and say, oops, but wait a minute, we've got all these affidavits and exhibits to prove there really is a fact issue. I don't see that that's much different on the bottom line from having the opportunity to raise the constitutional issue and not doing so. I think that there's an even better reason other than that, though, is that the constitutional issue requires a fact finding. It requires the presentation of evidence. The Pilcher case from the Fifth Circuit, on which they rely as the basis for the constitutional argument, is exactly that. The state lost in that case because they failed to present evidence of necessity for the requirement of inclusion of a voter registration number. There was a long evidentiary hearing that, because of the state's failure to produce evidence, they lost. The court did not hold in that case that the requirement for inclusion of voter registration number was facially unconstitutional. They said it was unconstitutional as applied because of the evidence produced in that case, and no more. The proper remedy. Yes.
Counsel, could you address very quickly? He raised three names that he said were simply errors, and those three names would give him the 250. He said he challenged Jeffrey Lazar and not Sherman Lazar.
The exhibit, I believe it's H, lists the name Jeffrey Lazar and lists a location from Jeffrey Lazar on the petitions. The location on the petitions, which I believe is 18B3, but I won't swear to it, is the correct location. If somebody wants to look and see if, in fact, the listed person across there has a voter registration number, you turn to page 18B3, you find Sherman Lazar, and he doesn't have a voter registration number. The final exhibit, the one on which the Court of Appeals did its reduction analysis, cumulatively lists everybody just by page and location on the page. And that page, listing all the defects for that signature, properly lists Sherman Lazar. It doesn't list the name, but it doesn't list any name, right one or wrong. It lists the page and the location on the page. As Sherman Lazar's location without a voter registration number.
And what about Crystal Dennis?
Crystal Dennis is one of those that has a different name. The petition is signed Crystal Dennis, and there's an address on there. The voter registration certificate that they submitted to the Court of Appeals is Crystal Dawn Felder. I have a hard time figuring out how Crystal Dennis and Crystal Dawn Felder are the same person, and how that person is either countable as a registered voter or as having the correct registration number. Merely because somebody wrote down Crystal Dawn Felder's registration number for Crystal Dennis and they happen to have the same first name, in my mind, isn't any evidence that Crystal Dawn Felder and Crystal Dennis are the same person. They could very easily be mother and daughter, or mother-in-law and daughter-in-law, or any of a variety of other combinations. There is one error in the Court of Appeals count that I will concede. I conceded in the brief. The count on the category that contains no city and no zip code. The Court of Appeals used the number 7 and the correct number is 6.
So what number do you state they do have as the correct number of cities?
There are 27. How many do they have correct in total?
Total.
302 less 106 is 196. Net signatures that are correct after excluding every error that we claim and not counting anything duplicate. I'll be glad to provide the breakdown on that.
Okay, now they're at 240. The number we had was 247. If you're saying that's wrong, it should be 196?
No, the 247 number is based just on the issues the Court of Appeals reached. I agree that that number should be 248 and not 247. But I think it's important to remember that there were many issues we raised in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals didn't have to reach, because once it got down below 250, it just stopped. There was no need to go further and address other issues that weren't necessary to the opinion. Those other issues were raised in the Court of Appeals. I carried them forward in our response in this court. And if you deduct all of those, you get down to 106. I think there's one other thing that's extremely important in this case, the tolerable sloppiness. In this case, there were 123 signatures challenged, containing 184 errors. Out of 302 signatures, that means that about 40% of the signatures have problems of one kind or another. And if you just count up the number of errors contained in all those signatures, you get up to about 60%.
You aren't challenging terms of this name, no. Printed one way, signatures the other.
No. The method we used for counting all of these was if they included anything that looked like a street address, it was counted as a street address. Anything that looked like a zip code was counted as a zip code.
But I noticed there's a Esther Johnson whose signature is Johnson S.
That was not counted for that reason. There was some question by everybody whether her name was Esther Johnson or Johnston Esther. The order of the name did not affect how she was counted or excluded on any of the counts.
I understand how you did it, but under your strict instruction, should we be saying that if you get the wrong zip code on there, does it count?
I don't know how you could. I would not go so far as to say the wrong zip code. And maybe on total, complete, strict construction, you should.
Why do these voter registration numbers have to be right then?
How else can you be assured of being able to easily verify the signatures? I think that's the problem. When you get a wrong registration number and you don't know who the person is, and the name may not match exactly to the way it is registered, if you have a wrong registration number, you're just lost in the desert trying to dig through the sand, especially in a county like Harris that has a large quantity, I don't know how many, 500,000 voters. At least they've computerized now.
I take it, that this was a signature by Ms. Brady would not obtain at a petition signing party that was sponsored by a party like in previous years?
Maybe they were, maybe they won't. I'm sure some of them were.
I'm asking the wrong part.
I'm sure some were. The bottom line to this case is that the statute's plain and clear. The statute says what it means and means what it says. The only way to ensure consistency throughout the state to the different party chairmen, the different county party chairmen, and the different state chairmen from year to year, and the consistent results with each individual court of appeals, is to have the same standard that's clear and is easily applicable. If the information's there, the signature's good. If the information's not there, the signature's not good. Prevents uncertainty, prevents being applied differently in different parts of the state at different times of the year, or depending on whether the candidate's an incumbent or a challenger. Provides the certainty that's necessary to stop this problem that we have on having a challenge of signatures. If we make it black and white, then the decision's real easy, and it can be made at the first step of the party rather than having to take it to the courts ultimately.
Before you sit down, let me just ask you a question on a related issue. Is the issue before us here today the same issue in Shipley versus Carlos Correa and Harris County Democratic Executive Committee? Are they different issues?
Many of the issues are the same. I skimmed Shipley once this morning. I don't know that maybe the constitutional issues. Most of the issues are the same. I am not totally convinced that that everything the Court of Appeals and Shipley ordered in the remedy provision was necessary. Based on what I've told you before, I think they could have gone a step further and ordered him removed from the ballot. Maybe I'm missing your question.
No, that's correct. No, I.
Okay.
Are they different courts of appeals? I haven't even bothered
to look. Yes, Shipley is the first court of appeals.
Same court?
No, this is out of 14.
14.
Yes.
And they basically reached the same result and use the same standard or not?
They did reach the same result on the same standard. The opinions were remarkably similar. The same kinds of things were excluded in both cases.
Again, with regard to the remedy and what you told me about the Marcellot, you would have us declare that the Court of Appeals did that the Brady name should go off the ballot.
That's correct.
And that you envision that would be implemented by not reprinting all the ballots in those 14 counties, but whether it's computer voting or paper balloting to issue Marcellots?
That is the only way I can envision. That's the way it was done 2 years ago, or at least that's the way I was told it was done 2 years ago. And it didn't seem to present any problems 2 years ago in the Cohen versus Jim Scott race.
Any other questions? Thank you,
counsel.
You don't have very long.
Please, Court, I'll just say hello. And then probably go back, but I will say this, if I may say it facetiously. About 10 days ago, I flunked an English test, and I think I'm right on my mathematics today. And rather than take your time and argue mathematics again, I would just refer you to my co-counsel there has gone into the mathematics quite well, I believe. We have the exhibits attached. If we follow those exhibits, I think that maybe I passed my math test today. The other thing I would like to just say in a minute's time and in council, I had come prepared, I thought, to talk about remedies and the questions addressed to him, and I think he's talked about it very carefully and given you what I believe to be the law also, and that is that there is a difference between the requirements of the statute and the requirements of the Constitution on the word eligibility. I think eligibility is a constitutional requirement. If we look at the statute, we're talking about how we put names on the ballot and who would be certified to that ballot. I think the remedy would be for the court to direct that the county chairman of each of the 14 counties would be to reject the application to be on the ballot and that notify the candidate that they're not going to be included. Again, as Judge Doggett has indicated, I think the only way to do that would be through the printing process. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel. Mm-hmm. Any I'm sure you won't use it.
But hopefully. As to what you do when you don't have a voter registration number, you do what Ms. Dunn did. You send a list of names to Mr. Smith, and he'll give you the numbers. On the issue of incorrect zip codes, the Court of Appeals has said that an incorrect number is no number, so that if we follow the letter of the rule articulated by the 14th Court, your incorrect zip code is no zip code. I would say that if you misspelled a city name like Waxahachie, there'd be no city.
Counsel, what if you assigned Crystal Dennis, but the name is Crystal Dawson Felder?
The logical thing to do, Judge, would be to challenge it on incorrect name. In this instance, you have a woman whose last name changed, who has the same address, the same voter registration number, and the same.
Did she write the number in?
Yes, she did. As a matter of fact, if you looked at the signatures, the Crystal is there, the last name has changed. In the period she signed, I believe, on November the 7th of 89, and the certificate that we obtained came in January. So some event occurred during that time in which this woman changed her last name. And I wouldn't stray beyond the record as to what kinds of events can happen, but women are known to change their last name. The point on strict compliance is that if you have a rule that is so rigidly enforced, you are asking, you are inviting constitutional error, because the point is that the associational rights to political speech are not that inflexible. There's nothing.
There's a $2,000 filing fee, and you pay $1,999.99. Does that create the same type of constitutional problem?
No. The assuming that charging the fee is not in itself unconstitutional,
right,
which we passed in Bullock, and the Supreme Court said when Texas did that, it was unconstitutional. So you have this system, so you don't have to pay.
Okay,
these
well, let's
orders.
Go to, I don't know, a cheaper filing.
Okay.
For some other office.
But
that's no problem because it's so easy that everybody can ascertain it. Or?
I think that in the sense of paying the fee, provided the fee itself is not onerous, it can be readily ascertained. The question you get into with this is the notion that you want to provide information for verification, and when you can verify, can you still turn around and use this statute as a sword to chop off voters who want to have a candidate on the ballot? I think that it is ripe. By the way, just so the record's clear, Mr. Slagle's brief in the 14th Court specifically discussed a Pilcher versus Raines in 14. There was a brief exchange on it. Because we have no record, I won't try to recreate what was or wasn't said. In that regard, I stand in my post-submission brief in the Court of Appeals as to my allegation under oath that there was a fact dispute. And that's before the Court, so I'm not going to respond to that. The question is, are there enough registered voters? And if there is a question as to their status as registered voters, how do you create a mechanism that will protect the right to have a candidate on the ballot and give the other party the opportunity to make sure there hasn't been fraud? The proposal that we had of a rebuttable presumption that says, I have a complaint with this signature, filed in the district court, by the way, Judge, I'd go to the district court. I think that that's where these issues should start. Unless there is a summary judgment level issue, and at that point to come back and come up with a valid voter registration certificate cures the informational need because the other side has the information and the voter stays on the ballot, on the petition. That is, in a nutshell, my summary. I appreciate your kind attention to all the paper that we've submitted.
Is there a distinction between a defect in the application and an eligibility requirement so that 141032, I guess it is, applies rather than 172058A?
I construe those two provisions differently than my brother, Mr. McKinney. I think that there is a difference. Basically, the 141, it says that you can challenge, and it gives a right of challenge up to a period of time. The second question is what point can you take somebody off the ballot? And I think that you can read those two together as creating a right to challenge, and the question is what time can you interfere with the ballot?
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the business of the court in this matter, and the marshal will please adjourn the court.
Yes, please rise.